From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. West Point grad, Vietnam veteran, a proud career military man. And Andrew Bacevich is warning that America, from the White House right down to popular culture, has fallen dangerously in love with military might. It has become, he says, a country seduced by war. In his new book, The New American Militarism, this soldier scholar describes a dangerous new American union of militarism and utopian ideology. A union, he says, that is turning the United States into a nation that believes unquestioningly in the primacy of armed power. Tonight on Point, a soldier scholar's tough critique of America's infatuation with military might. But first, we begin tonight with the latest from Rome, where CNN and Italian news agencies are reporting that a Vatican source is saying Pope John Paul II has been given the last rites of the Roman Catholic Church as his health has deteriorated late tonight. Joining me now is Jeff Israeli, Rome bureau chief for Time magazine. Jeff Israeli, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
What is the latest? We're getting these reports that the last rites have been given the sacrament of anointing the sick, as it's now called. What do we know about that and the state of the Pope's health at this moment?
Well, yes, different sources and different news agencies are reporting that these last rites, the sacraments of the infirmed, have been given to John Paul II. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're in the final moments or the final hours necessarily. It is a sacrament that is also given to people who are very sick to offer comfort. In fact, John Paul himself received these same sacraments back in 1981 when he was shot in St. Peter's Square in the assassination attempt. But with that said, the situation here is very serious. His condition is being described as very grave. He has the Vatican spokesman has confirmed that he has an infection, a urinary tract infection, and a high fever. So we are standing by to see how he reacts to the treatment that they are giving him to try to combat this infection.
Jeff, many Roman Catholics and many others around the world will be praying for the Pope's health tonight. There in Rome, at the Vatican, does it have the feeling of a death watch for this very prominent Pope?
Well, the faithful, about 2,000 or so faithful, gathered earlier this evening in Piazza St. Peter's Square to pray and to be close to the Pope. He is in his papal apartments. The Vatican has excluded any immediate return to the hospital, which could be a sign that things may be nearing the end. Sources have told us that the Pope himself and the officials around him would prefer, when the moment arrives, that he die in St. Peter's as opposed to the hospital. But there are a lot of prayers here in Rome and, as you said, around the world.
We'll be following this story tonight and in our second hour, looking much more closely. Jeff Israeli in Rome, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jeff Israeli, Rome bureau chief for Time magazine. Of all the enemies of public liberty, wrote Founding Father James Madison in 1795, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded. No nation, he said, can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. And yet, that is exactly where the United States finds itself today. And not by accident, says my guest tonight, career military man and self-described political conservative, Andrew Bacevich. Military supremacy, argues this soldier scholar, has become dangerously central to the American identity, and not just among Republicans or self-professed hawks. The result, he says, is a nation seduced by a new militarism that is a threat to the world, to national security, and to the country's democracy itself. Tonight on Point, Andrew Bacevich and the rise of a new American militarism and its dangers. You can join the conversation. Do you buy this long-time soldier scholar's warning? Has America been seduced by military might? At what cost? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations at Boston University. He graduated from West Point, served in Vietnam, and retired as a U.S. Army colonel after 23 years of service. His new book is The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Andrew Bacevich, welcome.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Andrew Bacevich, you're laying out a very arresting thesis, and you're laying it out with a kind of distinctive profile yourself. Self-described conservative, as we said, though you're drawing lines around your conservatism as opposed to what may be popularly understood as conservatism right now. A harsh, deep critique of the role that Americans have put their military in today, its place in the American mind, kind of a mythology of the military that Americans are buying into. Give us the heart of it. What's going on here?
Well, I hope it doesn't come across as too harsh, and I hope it doesn't come across as some kind of a anti-military or pacifist tract, because that's not where I'm coming from.
On the contrary, absolutely not. It's clear that your military career and kind of loyalties here are very strong, and it's anything but a pacifist tract. It makes it all the more interesting.
But the essence of the argument is that in the decades since the Vietnam War, and especially since the end of the Cold War, we have as a people, and I emphasize that, it's not some kind of a Bush conspiracy, we have as a people come to define our nation's strength and well-being in terms of military preparedness, in terms of military action, and in terms of a fostering of or nostalgia for military ideals. I mean, to expand on that just a little bit, at least I see that we've come to have a romanticized view rather than a realistic view of soldiers. We have come as a people to see military power as really the truest measure of national greatness, not our productivity, not the quality of our public education, but military power as the measure of national greatness. And perhaps most dangerously, we've come to have very outsized expectations of what we can achieve through the use of force.
We'll come back and look at this in detail, but take us to the conclusion quickly so we understand the arc along the way, the dangers of this seduction, as you call it, this new American militarism?
Well, I mean, the dangers, I think, are eloquently summarized in that quotation from Madison and any number of other quotations that one could cite, some of which I do cite in the book, from our founding fathers. I mean, the founding fathers were, above all, realists. The founding fathers understood the role of power in international politics. But the founding fathers, who cared deeply about the prospects for our democracy, for a republican form of government, also believed that maintaining excessive military power was a danger to a republican form of government, was something that was incompatible with the dreams that informed the founding of our nation. And we've forgotten all that. And I believe that we are falling prey to some of those dangers that they feared.
Americans are accustomed to hearing the general tenor of this critique from liberals and sometimes pacifists. You are neither of those. You laid out in the book, and I wish you would for us just briefly, your presumptions and predispositions coming into this research.
Well, I mean, my presumptions, as you said at the outset, I mean, I served in the military for a substantial period of time. I certainly view myself as a patriotic America. I mean, frankly, I love this country. I care deeply about this country, and have come to conclude that we've jumped off the precipice in terms of our sense of what military power can do. Again, the argument in the book is by no means an attack on the Bush administration, but it seems
no, they're fair, hardly exempt, but they're not alone right, in taking.
But
their
it seems
fire.
Fair to me to say that the preventive war, a war of choice, an unnecessary war against Iraq, is the clearest manifestation of where this new American militarism leads, and the cost that we have already suffered, whether we're talking $300 billion and counting, whether we're talking 1,600 U.S. dead and counting, whether we're talking the loss of our standing in the world, this is an indicator of where we're headed because of this unrealistic view of military power.
And this from a longtime soldier who warns that at risk with this new militarism, as Andrew Bacevich describes it, American global standing, as he just said, national security, democracy itself, Jack Beatty, this is a tough, thoroughgoing critique that gets way past the headlines and down near the American heart and where it's turning these days.
Yeah, and if you play it back to the 90s, I mean, you can almost say that the superpower competition with the Soviet Union, which we saw as containing Soviet power, was actually containing American power. Because as soon as that war, as soon as the Cold War was over and we could intervene without exacerbating superpower tensions, we went at it with a will, and Iraq is the last example. The current example,
And not the last. If it goes on, Andrew Bacevich says, we're talking tonight with Andrew Bacevich. His new book is The New American Militarism. You can join the conversation. Have we all, or most of us, fallen under the spell of superpower militarism? What consequences lie there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're hearing tonight a soldier scholar's critique of America's infatuation with its military and its negative impact, he says, on American world standing, on American security, on American democracy. My guest is Andrew Bacevich. He's professor of international relations at Boston University and author of the compelling new book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. You can join us tonight. Have we come to think of the U.S. military as the solution to a preponderance of world problems? Have 21st century Americans made a fetish of military power? Is it strange to you to hear a career military man charging this country is too infatuated with its military? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew Bacevich, at the start of the book here, just before the introduction, you quote Archibald MacLeish, the poet, from his 1939 poem, America Was Promises. And you quote his lines, East were the dead, kings, and the remembered sepulchres. West was the grass. West, as in the United States, I guess. Lay out for us before all of this, because as you say, we're so deep in this, it's hard even to look beyond what you describe sometimes. What was the vision? What's the older ideal that you're appealing to here, the vision of America and its truer sources of power?
You know, when I was a kid growing up in the Midwest, way back in the 50s, the phrase New World still had a certain currency.
It's where we live.
Meaning, mm-hmm. Capital N, capital, mm-hmm. capital mm-hmm. W. The phrase, I think, has pretty much disappeared now. But my recollection, as a young boy, was that it was a new world because the people who came here in the 17th century, intended it to be radically different from the old world. And they intended to be radically different in that the old world was, Europe, was a place of power politics, of wars, continuous wars, of bloodshed. And as a consequence of all that, a place in which it was impossible for the individual to enjoy real freedom.
The old world.
The old world. And that's what we have somehow managed to lose, this sense of our country, this place, being radically different. We have instead embraced those notions of power politics and of war. And it's costing us dearly in an immediate sense. But it also, I think, implies forfeiting or forgetting those founding ideals and those founding hopes and expectations.
We'll talk about why that's happened, and you laid a very interesting thesis. But first, give us the evidence. What's the evidence of what you're describing the country's become, of this new place and this mythologizing, as you describe it, of the military?
Well, I think, the most, and it is, as you were suggesting a second ago, some of these things are right there in front of us, and they are facts that we all know, but we've become so accustomed to them that we have lost our ability to appreciate their significance. But the answer to your question is that militarism manifests itself first of all in the cost and configuration of our forces and in the way we use them. I mean, think about it. Today, the United States spends more on its military than does the rest of the world put together. We're spending something on the order of $500 billion, a half a trillion dollars a year. If you add up the defense budgets of every other country in the world, they don't reach that. Now, that's a circumstance that is unprecedented in history. It's something that we really all know, and yet we shrug off. You know, we've got U.S. forces stationed in dozens of countries around the world. We all know as citizens that 60 years after the end of World War II, 60 years after the end of World War II, we still have forces in Europe and in Japan, which are liberal democracies. We all know that we now have forces in Central Asia. Now, 10 years ago, Central Asia was a place that, well, most Americans wouldn't have been able to find on a map. And if they did,
Kyrgyzstan,
it seemed like it was on the
Kazakhstan.
Other side of the moon. And yet the reality is, almost certainly, we're going to have U.S. forces stationed in Central Asia for the next decade or two decade or three decades.
And there's talk of little bases all over the place, forward bases, bases.
And we shrug these things off. We don't stop and say, well, what is the implications of this? What does this say about our national priorities, about the way we see ourselves and the way we see the world?
What's the dream or the mindset that our Americans are in, as you describe it, that leads them to shrug this off, to take it as just a given?
I think that we've come to defer excessively to a government and defer in particular to an executive branch. And again, it's not just Bush. It's Clinton. It's Bush's father. It's President Reagan. We've come to defer to a political elite that tends to think in terms of every problem is a military problem, or at least every problem has a military solution. We have a Congress that, instead of actually serving to check the executive, a Congress that failing to step up to its constitutional responsibility to decide when we should go to war, basically lays down and rolls over.
Andrew Bacevich, West Point grad, career military man, author of the new book, The New American Militarism. Andrew, I've just got to read a bit from this because you've laid it down in a really arresting way. Here's a paragraph in your introduction. The marriage of military metaphysics, you call it, with eschatological ambition, whoa, is a misbegotten one. Contrary to the long-term interests of either the American people or the world beyond our borders, it invites endless war and the ever-deepening militarization of U.S. policy as it subordinates concern for the common good to the paramount value of military effectiveness. It promises not to perfect but to distort American ideals as it concentrates ever more authority in the hands of a few more concerned with order abroad than with justice at home. It will accelerate the hollowing out of American democracy. As it alienates people and nations around the world, it will leave the United States increasingly isolated. If history is any guide, writes Andrew Bacevich, it will end in bankruptcy, moral as well as economic, and in abject failure. Is it that clear what this recipe, these ingredients, lead to?
Well, it's clear to me. I mean, the language, I suppose, sounds a little hyperbolic, but the track record of militarism in history, militarism that that Americans once uniformly condemned, it's not a story that has a happy ending. It doesn't have a happy ending if you're Germany. It doesn't have a happy ending if you're Japan. Now, I don't think that American militarism, as it exists today, is a carbon copy of German militarism or Japanese militarism of the 20th century. But these tendencies that I've tried to describe do constitute militarism, and it's not going to end happily. And what's most, I think, disturbing is that were we true to ourselves, were we, if we could recall the vision of the founders, we would know for a certainty that it's not going to end happily. And
you're saying it's because we're in the mindset, the dream, the mythologizing that we're not seeing that
with clarity.
Absolutely.
I mean, again, simply because the Iraq War is one of the things we chew on day after day. I mean, the expectations that shock and awe back in the spring of 2003 would easily dispose of the Saddam Hussein regime and somehow neatly transition to a democratic order. The fact that those notions had widespread credibility, and I don't mean to say that everybody mm-hmm. bought them, but certainly
those were the watchwords. Those were the bywords.
And President Bush had enough support to implement his policy. The very fact that those notions would have achieved widespread credibility is suggestive of the way in which many of us have been seduced by these expectations about neat, surgical, high-tech force. And it's dangerous.
And as a longtime military man, you're saying this is a kind of magical thinking, a kind of magical realism, not realism. Give us the why. Why, in your view, has the country, fallen into this right. mindset, a kind of trap, as you describe?
Well, the why actually constitutes the larger part of the book. And the why begins with the 60s in Vietnam. I mean, here from the vantage point of the year 2005, there are many Americans who view the 60s as a time of opening up, as a time in which obsolete barriers were torn down, in which freedom,
a liberation decade,
and that notion still has widespread purchase, but there were tens of millions of other Americans then and now mm-hmm. that rejected that interpretation, that viewed the 60s as a disaster.
Militarily, morally,
this is when we
politically.
Lost. We were defeated in Vietnam. We fell behind the Soviets. We lost confidence in ourselves. Important moral values were tossed overboard. And my argument is that it's those groups, those people who viewed the 60s as a disaster, who came to view the reconstitution of American military power, the rebuilding of the services, the celebration of traditional military values as the antidote, as the way to roll back the effects of the 60s that they viewed as nefarious. Mm. They didn't do this because they said, we're out to create militarism. They did it for what they viewed as a necessary purpose to rebuild the nation, to make it stronger, to restore its self-confidence, to try to restore certain moral values. But what they got, or more correctly, what we got, mm-hmm. was full-blown militarism.
With the consequence, you argue, that the country's sense of itself has never been more wrapped around military power than it is today. Jack Beatty, I want to get you in here. This tension has a history. It's interesting, Andrew Bacevich served in Vietnam, 69-70. He bases this new militarism, as he calls it, he roots it in that time, but there were warnings before Vietnam.
That's certainly true, but I think he's got a profound insight here into what has happened. And I think one of the reasons is that Vietnam was not the lessons were not learned. It was an amnesiac war almost as soon as it was over. And especially what the Pentagon Papers showed about the war, what they showed is that the presidency is a dangerous office, just as Madison said it was, that it was tempted, presidents were tempted to use war to escape from domestic political predicaments or to strengthen themselves for elections, but at all costs. not to lose, because to lose the wall would be to lose the election. From Truman to Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, the papers make clear this motive from the White House was as powerful as anything else. Now, that insight should demystify the presidency for all Americans forever, and yet it hasn't. People speak of the president as our commander-in-chief. He is not. That is, he is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And I think that this goes right to the top and to the, as it were, the unlearning we've done, or the lack of processing of what Vietnam showed us about the role of elites in immersing us in these wars, and for the lowest reasons.
I want to turn to our callers. Many have been waiting to talk with Andrew Bacevich, author of the new book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Joe is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good evening, Colonel. I have a question regarding whether or not you think this shift in society's attitudes or perceptions has any correlation with the decreasing percentage of the general population, especially maybe percentage of political leadership that has served in the military and perhaps has been a little more exposed to some of the dangers and hazards and realities of combat and things of that nature.
It's a great question, Joe, and Andrew Bacevich has raised it recently.
Yeah, in a word, yes. One of the, I think, ironic aspects of the new American militarism is that it doesn't lead all of us citizens to rush down to our local recruiter so that we can join up. On the contrary, this militarism has expressed itself in a national policy, it really almost unanimously endorsed, to contract out the function of national defense to a very small, relative to the size of the population, professional elite. And the rest of us basically cheer from the sidelines. The rest of us have forfeited what again, back if you look back at the founding, was seen to be a function of citizenship, a responsibility of citizenship to defend the country. Now we have other people do that, and because we have other people do that, it is easier, I think, for us to avoid confronting the very real implications of the military policies that we have embraced.
Is it your sense that within the ranks of the military, let's say within the officer ranks, is this view shared? Are you seen as a maverick, or are there lots of military officers saying, what's going on? We're being asked to do things that are kind of a fantasy, and we don't see, you know, all these people signing up to do it.
I have to say, I honestly don't know. You're very kind to refer to me as a soldier scholar. I tend to view myself as somebody who was once a soldier who now has become a teacher and a writer.
23 years don't vanish overnight,
well,
though.
They don't. But, I mean, my general sense, and this is only general, I don't keep in close touch with people who are still in uniform, is that the Iraq War certainly is not the war that that they wish to be fighting. I talk in the book about the officer corps' reaction to Vietnam, and certainly the officer corps plays a major role in this campaign to rebuild American military power. But it's not to rebuild it to go fight other Vietnams, to go be bogged down in other quagmires. Their aim is to rebuild the military as a conventional force that will be used sparingly. If they have to go somewhere, get the job done quickly, and come home. It is clear that the present war is having pretty significant ill effects on the cohesion, discipline, sustainability of the forces, in particular the Army. And I have to think that there are many officers in the present-day officer corps who view all that as worrisome.
Is the uniformed voice, in spite of this militarism, is it somehow smaller in today's conversation in deciding what we do with the military?
It has become smaller. it's only a peripheral part of my book, but I've written elsewhere, others follow this closely, that the civil-military relationship at the top in our country is fundamentally dysfunctional. And the ability to integrate professional military advice with civilian decision-making is deeply flawed.
Soldier scholar, and I still think it he qualifies, Andrew Bacevich is with us tonight, 23-year Army veteran, retired colonel, now professor of international relations. His new book is The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. You can join us. Have Americans, conservative and liberal, bought into a military-centric view of the world? With what consequence? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're hearing a soldier scholar's critique of America's infatuation with its military. My guest is Andrew Bacevich, retired Army colonel, professor of international relations at Boston University, author of the new book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. You can join the conversation tonight. Have we become the new Romans, trusting in the armed legions, not in elbow grease and ideals? What's happened to the anti-militarist tradition in the city of a city on a hill, leading by example at home with realism abroad? Are Democrats as responsible as Republicans, as Andrew Bacevich says, for this new militarism? And is an obsession with military power corrosive to democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. First of all, I'd like to say I think the author hits the nail on the head in terms of the sentiments for a lot of people in the country. The second thing is, I have two questions. One is, does the author feel that the first Gulf War was a mistake in terms of setting a precedent for unilateral military action? And the second question I have is regards the glorification of military might in terms of the media and Hollywood and things like that. And I was wondering what he might think about that.
We'll get both of those answered, Paul. And thank you for your call, Andrew Bacevich. First to the first Gulf War.
Well, I think that the first Gulf War played a pivotal role in getting us where we are today, not in terms of unilateralism, because it wasn't a unilateral war, and it was a war that in fact had the go-ahead from the UN Security Council, but it was pivotal on account of where it fell and how it was erroneously, I think, interpreted. And where it fell was immediately at the end of the Cold War. Going back to my days as a kid. I mean, when I grew up, I understood that the U.S. was a major military power. But I must say that I also had the impression that it was an emergency measure. We had to have a big military because we were engaged in this emergency. Now, the emergency was a long one, not a short one.
But it wasn't the natural state, the default position.
That's exactly right. That somewhere out there, the Cold War was going to end, and we would return to a more normal circumstance.
The Gulf War pushed it just the other way as it ended.
The Gulf War happens, and the Gulf War seems to be a decisive victory. Mm-hmm. It's not. Mm-hmm. And therefore creates this impression that, hey, maybe military power is really a good thing apart from the Cold War. Perhaps the retention of military power is something that can pay great dividends down the road. In other words, the occurrence of the Persian Gulf War, the first one, when it came, preempted any serious debate in the country about, well, now that the Cold War is over, what ought to be
what should
a
we get
proper
back to
and
here?
Realistic military posture? So I think that's where that fell. With regard to the glorification of the military
in popular culture, often seen as patriotism,
and I try to talk a little bit about the role of popular culture, in particular the movies, in fostering these attitudes. Again, to crank back to Vietnam, certainly popular culture's view of the military during the war and right after the war was highly anti-military. Anti-war bled into an anti-militarism, for which I have no sympathy. But by the time we get into the early 1980s, there's a turn. I mean, in many respects, the greatest symbol of that turn is the movie Top Gun, a huge hit in its day.
Super blockbuster, Tom Cruise.
And one that depicted military service as clean, as tidy, as glamorous, as shorn of the filth and dirt and error.
Everybody was back in the locker room and looking spiff five minutes after contact.
Looking very spiff.
Right.
Looking very buff.
Yeah.
And so I think that, again, it's not a conspiracy. The movie makers are out trying to make a buck. They're not trying to necessarily pursue a particular political agenda.
But they're great marketing minds. They sensed this as something the country would grab onto.
They read it and they play it back, and in playing it back, they reinforce it, and so it kind of goes back and forth. And it's relatively significant that all this happens at the time when President Reagan is becoming president. Reagan sees embracing soldiers and a celebration of soldiers as central to his agenda to try to restore the self-confidence of the nation after Vietnam. And again, it's not evil, it's not a conspiracy, but an unintended, unanticipated consequence of all this, I argue in the book, is militarism.
Keith is calling from Whitesburg, Kentucky. Hi, Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just wondering, have we become a nation where the rich man write the laws that the poor man must defend? They was talking, you know, about recruiting and visiting certain high schools versus visiting, you know, certain colleges.
Yep.
And I just wanted, you know, comments on that.
Keith, thanks for your call. Andrew Basevich.
Well, the simple answer is yes. We have become a nation in which people of color, people of the working class, bear a preponderance of the burden for military service. Now, there are many, many exceptions to that. My own son is serving in the Army right now.
Mm.
But by and large, in the aftermath of Vietnam, with the creation of this all-volunteer force, the white middle class, and especially members of the political and economic elite, have chosen not to serve, have chosen to have other people serve. Now, under the stress of the Iraq War, that may be coming apart. There's some indication with this looming recruiting crisis that those who, and I'm thinking here particularly of African Americans, who have stepped up to the plate, are deciding, as Vice President Cheney described his own circumstance back in the 1960s, are deciding that they now have other priorities. And that's a problem.
And we see those numbers drop. We've just got a couple. Yes, Jack.
You know, when Congress voted the war, only one member had a son who was an enlisted man. Tom is a Johnson of South Dakota. One man.
Right, and there's a whole new reality. We've just got 2 minutes left. Two questions. One, you say this excessive military power is incompatible with Republican government, a threat to democracy. Why? And two, how do we turn this trend around?
Well, it's incompatible with democracy, in particular because it feeds into this further empowerment of the executive and the diminishing of the authority of the Congress.
Makes the president a demigod, as you were.
Well, as Jack Beatty said, it's the president has become advertised, markets himself as the commander-in-chief. I mean, the classic image here being President Bush landing on the aircraft carrier in his aviator suit. That's not what our Republican form of government is all about. I think it's also bad for democracy, again, to repeat myself, in the sense that it contributes to this further attenuation of our concept of citizenship, I just get benefits, I have no obligations. That's not healthy. How do we reverse it?
You're saying not pacifism. You're right. The common cause is of restoring good sense and realism to American thinking about war, armies, and soldiers.
And how you do that, I think, is a number of things. Number one, abrogate the Bush doctrine of preventive war. See force as something that is used as a last resort. Reconfigure our forces chiefly for defending this country rather than chiefly for global power projection. Call on our allies to shoulder their fair share of defending themselves. Reconstitute the tradition of the citizen soldier. Those sorts of things.
Andrew Bacevich, it's a compelling, a mind-opening book. We thank you for it and for your time tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, retired Army colonel, author of the new book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Jack Beatty, it's a big picture being drawn here. This is maybe only the beginning of a turn, maybe.
Maybe, and education can help to change it. All people have to do is read real war memoirs to see what war is about.
Amen to that. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, inside today's report from the Presidential Commission investigating pre-Iraq war intelligence failures. This is On Point. The Presidential Commission, charged with investigating intelligence failures in the run-up to war in Iraq, issued its final report today, charging that the intelligence community was dead wrong in its assessment of Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. Officially called the Commission on the Intelligence Capabilities of the United States Regarding Weapons of Mass Destruction, the panel was appointed by George W. Bush in February 2004. It presented its 600-page report to the president this morning and recommended 74 changes to the structure of America's intelligence community, while it referenced the ongoing debate over possible heavy politicizing of intelligence before the war. It did not lay blame on the Bush administration. Michael Isikoff is investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked him if this report broke new ground in our understanding of intelligence failures in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Well, there's certainly some new details and some new fairly blunt language, much of which you may have heard before, or we all may have heard before, perhaps in the media, from pundits, from various members of Congress. But to have a commission flat out say that virtually everything that the United States government said in the run-up to the war in Iraq about our reasons for going to war was wrong is pretty striking. And even though you sort of know it all already, it's pretty stunning when you read the details again. And the report does have some new details about many of the episodes that have been largely covered in the media and previous reports, the forged documents about Iraqi uranium, the reliance on this one screwball source named Curveball, who turned out to be a complete fabricator and yet was virtually the sole basis for the claims about Iraq's alleged mobile biological weapons labs. So, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of, additional details, but the basics have been known for some time.
This is, of course, the Presidential Commission appointed by the
right.
President and with quite conservative judge Lawrence Silberman and, of course, a former Virginia senator. Where do they lay blame, ultimate blame?
Well, they lay blame entirely on the U.S. intelligence community, and they absolve, conveniently enough, the White House and the administration for any responsibility here. And look, that's where the criticism of this commission is going to come in. You know, I think the answer from Judge Silberman today is, well, our mission wasn't to look at or investigate the policymakers and what they made of this intelligence. They'd make a sort of sweeping statement early on that there was no political pressure. We couldn't find any example of political pressure. But the report really doesn't examine the overall atmosphere that was set by the rather strident and continuous statements by people in the White House and the administration about the desire to overthrow Saddam and how that may have shaped the thinking of the intelligence community. You know, to say that isn't to absolve the intelligence community, because the report talks about these stream of reports that were being sent to the president directly and senior executives that, he says, were even more alarmist and was sort of reinforcing the impression that the CIA and the intelligence community had this solid basis for making claims about Iraq's WMD, and yet it was all based on the same fragmentary and erroneous intelligence to begin with.
But Michael Isikoff, isn't there something, I don't know, almost downright farcical about not making the political link? They say they found no evidence that political pressure from the White House or Pentagon contributed to the mistaken intelligence, except at this point, through your reporting and that of many others, we know a lot about Dick Cheney spending all this time at the CIA, leaning about what went on inside the Pentagon, developing alternate paths to push
kind of aggressive story about what was going on there, about how Colin Powell was fed all this stuff and couldn't figure it out and took it to the UN. I mean, isn't there an absurd element to disconnect all this from the pressure of the White House?
That's certainly going to be a perspective on this report. I mean, look, you had
Is that just a perspective? Is that, though, just a perspective? Isn't there enough factual evidence on the table?
Well, look, what Senator Robb, former Senator Robb, said today is, and something that had been previously said before by the Senate Intelligence Committee, is that no intelligence analyst came forward and said, I was pressured, instructed, encouraged to change my reporting and change my thinking about the nature of Iraq's weapons program. And in that narrow sort of sense of criminal evidentiary standard, I believe that's true. We don't have the smoking gun memo or the smoking gun witness who says, I told them this was wrong and they made me change it. But the report does sort of glide over the fact, although it mentions the fact that there were dissents within the intelligence community, the dissents from the State Department, from the Energy Department about Iraq's nuclear weapons program, for instance. Yet what it doesn't examine is, you know, those dissents were included in some of the reporting. They were out there. If the policymakers wanted to hear more about them, they could have been asking a lot more questions, and yet they didn't. So in that sense, they sort of completely cut off, you know, a whole logical line of inquiry here that one would do if one were doing a complete investigation as to why we were wrong about Iraq's programs.
And finally, Michael, on the prescriptive front, we've now got the new National Intelligence Director, John Negroponte. There have been reforms in the intelligence realm. What does the report say about what's been done so far, whether it's sufficient, how great the challenge remains?
A lot more needs to be done, particularly on the matters of intelligence sharing. What the commission found is that a lot of the bureaucratic turf battles that we heard so much about in the postmortems after September 11th and were supposed to have been fixed are still going on. The FBI and the CIA still squabbling, Homeland Security being left out in the cold, and state and locals left out in the cold on getting and sharing intelligence. Intelligence agencies still looking at having this mentality, if it's our info, we own it, we can put restrictions on who gets it. So a lot of these problems we thought had been taken care of, this commission finds, are still there, calling for further structural changes, some pretty dramatic recommendations, particularly, although this is not squarely within their mandate, but particularly within the FBI and the Justice Department, reorganizing, having the FBI intelligence branches be overseen by the Director of National Intelligence. That's a huge cultural shift for the FBI, and it's going to be strongly resisted. But it is worth remembering, since the president asked for this report, unlike the 9/11 commission, which he did not ask for, this was his creation, so he is almost be certain to be strongly directing that agencies implement these recommendations.
Well, not a pretty picture, but then he takes no particular personal heat in here, so he's positioned, I suppose, to treat it that way. Michael Isikoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime.
Michael Isikoff is investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.